Hello, this is Fernando Calva with Altus Group. Have an opportunity to sit down with Jim Francis, Vice President of the Altus Group, and looking forward to interviewing him, talking about both personal, business, as well as anything he really chooses to talk about. So Jim, tell me a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you grew up, and maybe possibly one of your passions.
Okay, great. Thanks, Fernando. Well, we'll maybe start back where I'm kind of born and raised in the Baltimore area, kind of the northeast side of town. Raised by a single parent, lived in a little two-bedroom apartment, and went to high school locally at Loch Raven, where graduated in 1984. And after that, I put myself through college. So graduated in 1988 from the University of Baltimore. While at the University of Baltimore, I was able to do a lot of different activities, including becoming president of what was called the Accounting Society. Now it's Beta Alpha Psi.
That sounds fun. Yeah,
Beta Alpha Psi, a lot of fun, but we had as much fun as we could do with that organization, and had an opportunity to kind of network with a lot of the big eight firms, which then led to many job opportunities. So being in that position of leadership and helping to grow the organization eventually led to some nice connections that led to my first job out of college, which was at Arthur Andersen. So thankfully, a great opportunity for a career, but thankfully was gone about 10 years before their demise. So everybody knows the Arthur Andersen story in the accounting industry. So right out of college, you know, started in the audit group and spent about 2.5 years there. And after about 2.5 years of doing auditing, I realized I did not have a passion for that for the rest of my life. So wanted to try something new. So at that time, I transferred over to Andersen's federal income tax practice and spent about a year or so there. And at that time, some individuals that I work with and one particular manager was in charge of the state and local tax practice at Arthur Andersen, which was a completely new practice.
And where was that based out of?
That was out of Baltimore. Right. Our clients were mostly at the time in Maryland, but we did a lot of multi-state type work. So we were doing some multi-state income tax, franchise tax planning work, sales and use tax work, mostly in this area, but around the country. Arthur Andersen had a footprint everywhere, so we had resources that we could use. So this is going back to kind of the pre-internet, pre-email days.
Mm-hmm. So early 90s, right, late 80s. Right.
Yeah, so this would be early 90s, like 1990, 91 time frame. So we spent some time interacting with professionals around the country, pre-LinkedIn days. So that network of people, you know, we had to reconnect many years later once the technology, thankfully, came on board. So we started a practice there, and I got drafted into that, and quickly grew that to a, you know, an excess of seven-figure practice, and it was made a lot of money for Arthur Andersen. And that was in probably 1991, end of 91. Three individuals that I worked with at Andersen decided they had this nice state local tax practice. Let's see if they could go set up their own firm. And they did, and it was a firm called Stout, Causey & Horning, later SC&H Group. About 6 months after that, they had a couple of clients, and they could make payroll, and I kept in touch with them. And I was working at Andersen and doing well, managing a lot of different engagements because the people I'd worked with had set up their own company. But I always had kind of that entrepreneurial spirit, and the three individuals contacted me, asked me if I would join their firm. So 6 months after they had started, I became the first employee.
It's a great opportunity.
Yeah, it was a great opportunity. I mean, it was one of those where you kind of have to believe in yourself. Is there an opportunity to be successful? You know, I worked for a firm that, you know, Andersen probably had, I don't know, 50,000, 100,000 employees worldwide.
Down to three.
Four. So, you couldn't have asked for a different type of thing, but a lot of excitement starting a company from scratch, really. I mean, we had a few customers, but it was a business where the four of us, initially, you would pretty much spend all day on the phone trying to drum up business.
No, you were on the phone. Did you have a computer?
When I joined the firm, it's interesting you say that. So when I joined the firm and I interviewed with them in an office that was probably 16 feet by 20 feet with four desks all in the same area, no separation at all. Mm-hmm. It was one computer, and when I joined, we bought our second computer. And it was not a laptop. It was a desktop. So that was it, and that's what we started with. Where thankfully nowadays I'm sitting here with, you know, two monitors in my office and a little tiny computer compared to what we had to carry around back in those days. But that quickly changed as the technology went down. Thank goodness, because doing state and local tax work or doing any type of accounting work back in the late 80s, early 90s was probably not the most interesting. You spent a lot of time just waiting for the computers to calculate. You spent a lot of time hand cranking schedules using your 10 key at the time. So technology has been a wonderful thing for our industry. From analysis, from research, you know, we used to have to do all of our research.
Just the access to data.
Yeah, data access has been incredible to help us become more effective, more efficient, and allow better planning for our customers. So we were there. You would spend all day, I mean, literally half a day to all day probably on the phone in the beginning, calling everybody you knew, going to breakfast, going to lunches, going to dinners, anything to get business, to keep the door open, keep the lights on, to make money and grow business. That was, and you worked at least 6 days a week. Most of it was 7 days a week. So,
did you have to walk uphill when it snowed?
It was crazy. It was fun, and we had a good time though. I mean, we definitely knew how to have a good time, and it was a, you know, we had a softball team. We got our friends to play, so we would definitely go out and have a good time. Most evenings, we were eating dinner together. A lot of us were early with our families, mm-hmm. so. Families, you know, most of us didn't have children at the time, so it was a little easier to work that hard. But yeah, we started having kids and did have a kind of a family front environment. It was not one where you could continue that pace forever, though.
No, but you're starting a business.
Yeah, you start a business, you do what you need to do to succeed. So we did that, I would say, the first couple of years. We rapidly grew from when I joined as number four to about 10 or 11 people within a couple of years. So similar type mentality. People came in, you made calls during the day. You did the work, the client service work on evenings and weekends largely. So there, you know, it's a lot of 60-80 hour work weeks consistently for those, at least the first couple of years. Then you wait, you know, it was still 60-hour work weeks in year three, four, and five, because you had to work hard to grow the business, but the business did grow rapidly. And state and local tax was really one of the areas that allowed the business to grow. The firms that were out there were underserving clients. It was an afterthought a lot of times. To come out and help companies look at their property tax burden, especially personal property at that stage of our firm, sales and use tax issues, you know, unknown, unclaimed property. We started doing some work in that. A lot of multi-state income and franchise tax work. It was an afterthought by companies.
But the access to the real property data wasn't available unless you went to the courthouse.
So interesting back then when we first started, we didn't even do real estate work. We would refer that out to law firms because we thought that's what attorneys should do. This has gone back. Now we're looking at 1994. Yeah, so that's kind of what we did at the time, and it wasn't really a big focal point until probably for our firm, 1999, 2000. We said, you know, we should get into this business, and we ended up working with an attorney. It was an individual by the name of Bennett Gaines, and he had a real estate practice. Bennett had terminal cancer, so he knew we had a state and local tax practice. And thought this might be a good fit for us. So maybe kind of stepping back. So we had this practice, this SC&H practice. So we did audit work. We did something called accounts payable recovery audits, and we did state and local tax. Mm-hmm. And as we grew the firm, everybody did everything. And then eventually we said, this doesn't make a lot of sense. You know,
you're wearing too many hats.
Yeah, a lot of different hats.
Messing up your hair.
Yeah, you need exactly. You need to focus on something. So we started saying, okay, who works in the state and local tax area? Let's have them focus full-time on providing outstanding client service in the state and local tax arena. So I was involved in that practice very early on with several other people that are now with Altus that have stayed for many years that you may have a chance to talk to. Jeff Glock's been here for, I've been here for 24. I think Jeff's been here for about 20. And Corinne Crixton has been here mm-hmm. for about 18 or 19 years. And wow. Ed Ben has been here for 17 or 18 years. I mean, it's been a lot of us that end up getting involved in different areas of the practice, have been here for a very long time, and focused on state and local tax. So we had to get going back. So move fast forward, we were doing sales and use tax, unclaimed property, personal property tax work, mostly consulting, but some compliance, and some multi-state income and franchise tax work, but not a whole lot. And then Bennett was joined us and kind of gave us the entree into the real estate industry through some of his clients, and then, you know, Bennett eventually did pass away, but at the time he'd spent a couple of years kind of preparing our team and working with us mm-hmm. on real estate. And then we said, this is an area of practice that we can run with and grow. And we did, and we began to kind of grow that practice.
Now, was that, again, just local here in Baltimore? Was it national or regional?
So it started out, all of our practices really did start out with a local focus. You know, we were in Maryland. We knew Maryland law very well, and we could serve our clients very well. But the one thing we would do at the end of engagements would, if you would talk to your client about what they might have going on in any of those areas of tax, and if we could provide value in the state of Maryland and help them save money, and they were doing work across the country, we would then ask the question, what are you doing in these other states? And the typical response was, not much, nothing, don't know. So we said, let us look and take a look at this thing. So similar issues, you know, states all tax things differently. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, if it's in the real or personal property, it's what's the value of the property? So the same concepts are typically going to apply across the country. It's a matter of how do you actually put them into action. What does case law say out there? So a lot of case law research, a lot of review of, I'll say just the returns and the detail, kind of getting into all of the detail, looking for the opportunity, being creative. There's a lot of gray area in state and local tax. There mm-hmm. aren't a lot of rules that are 100% set. It's a judgmental type of business in many areas of taxation. So we would use our professional judgment and go to those other jurisdictions, sometimes partner with other people we had met through professional organizations such as IPT. So we would know people and kind of develop our network of professionals and would go and meet with assessors, show them our analysis, our review, which was pretty in-depth, a lot of times more in-depth than what they were used to seeing. So, for instance, on a real estate appeal, we might have a 20-page report. We might have a 100-page report outlining all the reasons why we thought the property might be overassessed. Because at the end of the day, it was on our process was, let's prove to them we've done everything we can do to show why we think we're right here. They may not agree, and if they didn't, we would go through the administrative appeal process.
Well, the burden of proof on an appeal is on us.
Right. So that's what we had to do. You had to really do your homework. You have to really understand the market, and especially if you were coming in. At that time, we were pretty much a Maryland-based business. If you're coming into another jurisdiction, you better prove that you know the community, you know the area. So we spent a fair amount of time traveling, getting out into those communities, driving around. Technology, again, kind of became a great equalizer, mm-hmm. and that you could access so much information through technology from your laptop, from your desk, from your house, wherever you were, to find out what are the demographics in the area, what are the sales that are occurring in the marketplace. Working with sometimes appraisers in those markets, but oftentimes we would do the kind of the first pass on our own. And we were successful. So a lot of times our clients might have started out with three or four properties in Maryland, and then we added Virginia or DC, and then we would, next thing you know, we might have 80 properties up and down the East Coast to maybe 80 or 90 properties throughout the entire country. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you do well with a client, you know, we're not the only people in the business. There are a lot of people that are out there. But if they're not providing good client service or great client service and not providing results, most companies are willing to,
you know,
have no second set of eyes. Right.
So you mentioned the word creative as well as, now I'm curious to see either what was your most challenging property or asset, and what was one of the most creative things that you had to introduce to a local local region, and what was the success on that?
Yeah, so creative. I mean, there's been hundreds of properties over the years to say that we've done. I think the most, maybe not creative, but the most interesting and challenging sometimes are those unique assets that you've never looked at before, whether it be a sports stadium or in the state of Maryland, a hospital. There's a for-profit hospital in the state of Maryland that we did work for. There was only one. Unlike our friends from Altus in Texas, where their specialty was in the healthcare field. Mm-hmm. So looking at things and saying, okay, this isn't like our typical industrial manufacturing type facility. What do we need to know? What do we do with this one? How do we approach that? And we actually, going back many years ago, we actually worked with what was CPAC at the time, which was then
Mark Watford's
team. So we worked with Trey Beasley on some appraisals for some of the properties we did, because we knew what we knew. We knew what we didn't know. We knew we had some opportunity, but we thought we should try to find the experts in the business, and we actually worked with Trey's group. So it's kind of interesting. If you mm-hmm. move forward, you know, 10 years later, we're all part of the same company.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it takes a lot of knowledge to know what you don't know.
Right.
And then it takes the instinct to reach out to those that do know what you don't know.
Right. Yeah. So some, you know, there have been cases over the years that are, you know, interesting ones where there are, you know, very large, significant refunds because we've seen exemptions missed for years, for generations in some cases, where our clients were paying taxes they should have never paid, just because no one knew, again, what they didn't know. So if we could find an opportunity through case law, typically on the law mm-hmm. side, trying to find something, and then analyzing, presenting it, writing it up, showing our clients our work. You know, they have to buy off and understand that we have a legal basis for what we're doing, and then after that, moving through the process. So when you have something that's very unique and interesting, you'd like to be able to settle with the assessor. But if it is unique, new, and interesting, you often will end up moving towards filing and potentially in court or settling right before you go to court. So those are probably been the more interesting ones when you need to come up with an idea that no one's thought about, or an idea that the law says it should be done this way, but no one has bothered to review or look into the law. Some of those are, you know, fair market value arguments on personal property. You know, for many years, many companies would just file a personal property return. They just send it in and get back an assessment and say that's correct. So, you know, some of the creative ideas or unique ideas is that personal property should be assessed at its fair market value in most jurisdictions, similar to real estate. But a lot of companies just have never really thought about what does that mean. You know, they would assume that fair market value be what a state or local table says, but those tables stop at 20% or 25% of value in some cases. And the reality is personal property depreciates more rapidly than those tables oftentimes. And it doesn't just magically stop depreciating at 20 or 25%. So taking those cases and then being successful and working through some of those matters with the assessors are some pretty interesting cases.
So Jim, back in the early 90s, you were the first hire from SE&H. And recently, Altus Group acquired the SALT practice from SE&H that you're leading. Why did you choose to go with Altus?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So So the ensuing 23 years or so at SE&H, we grew that practice to about 300 people, a little over 300, with offices in, about six states, mostly concentrated in the mid-Atlantic, though. But our state and local tax practice was around 90 professionals. And we were at that kind of critical juncture. Where are we going next? So within a public accounting firm, there's competing interest. You know, it's a privately held business, and each year you hopefully reap the rewards of a successful year. And you can do a couple things with it. You can either reinvest in practices, which we did very well at SE&H, and had grown to, you know, numerous practices in different areas, from audit, tax, to some technology consulting, to state and local. So investing in practices is one way that you do, where you take money out for the partner. So there's always a conflicting interest there. So that would also potentially limit some of the growth opportunities you would have. We saw this as, we're at a certain level, we believe, we want to do something bigger. We want to help grow a practice around the country, and what's going to help do that is additional resources, of which, you know, SE&H has kind of conflicted a little bit with some of the decisions that we would have to make as, as partners within that. And as a state and local tax partner, we wanted all the resources to be invested in growing our state and local tax practice. So a couple of years prior to the acquisition, I had a chance to meet with Jim Derbyshire, actually, at an IPT event, and just began a conversation and a relationship, personal, just kind of talking about what Altus's plans were and learning about Altus and the incredible growth and success they'd had in Canada, and what their plans were in general in the U.S. And when they acquired the CPAC entity, we had a great deal of respect for that team because we had worked with them in the past and thought, that's interesting. It's kind of a splash in our marketplace. And, you know, we met with Jim and thought, okay, this is interesting what they're doing here. Kept in touch with Jim and continued that conversation and kind of learned more about what Altus wanted to do in the U.S. with their growth plans, and thought we could be a good fit with that. Not just because we do real estate and personal property tax, which Altus does in the U.S., but because we bring a lot of other ancillary services in. You know, the unclaimed property, we call it transaction tax, so it's sales and use, multi-state income, and franchise tax, and gross receipts tax, as well as our locations and incentive strategies businesses. So a lot of these businesses pair very nicely with doing work in the real estate. So we thought if we can come in, partner with them, and help kind of lead that growth around the country, it would be a very nice fit. Plus, with Altus's track record of over the last 10 years, you're going from about, I think, 300 people to close to 3,000 people. Yeah, you know, an incredible amount of
growth.
Pretty
phenomenal.
Yeah, it's great growth to see. So you obviously, they're not just talking it, they're walking it. You know, they're going out, they're looking for acquisitions to grow. They're looking for organic growth. And to be a part of that was pretty exciting to the leaders and to our team, is to take those practices that are maybe smaller within SE&H and have an opportunity to grow them out, not just in this region, but nationally.
Yeah.
And the idea behind it is if you can provide services to clients and you can help them on the real estate side or personal property side, those same clients are going to have issues in all those other areas. Mm-hmm. You know, they're growing, hopefully, growing their businesses. They're making decisions on where they want to locate, which fits very nicely with our locations and incentive strategies businesses, helping them make site selections. Transaction taxes. You know, if you're looking at sales and use tax or gross receipts taxes, you know, jurisdictions make a lot of money in that area. They're out there auditing our clients all the time. And there's gray area in that area, in that area of tax, where an auditor may see something as being taxable when we may see that as being exempt. And there may be case law supporting those positions. So going out and representing clients and helping them save money was another thing to do. And the ability to kind of cross-sell and provide a lot of value to existing Altus clients, to our clients, as well as to help grow and expand that business around the country to kind of have that national footprint where we can serve our clients all over the country was really compelling to us.
Yeah, it almost seems like you're back in the early 90s with a telephone, but just with a much more powerful entity like Altus to go out and expand your relationships, continue to do a good job, and really just grow the practice organically through your existing clients.
Right, no, it's great. And Altus actually, you know, while still in its infancy, I think, in the U.S. with the size of it, there are a lot more companies out there that have heard of Altus, that know Altus. You know, they've done some acquisitions. The name is getting out there more through more clients around the country. And if your clients like you and want to continue working with you, they'll talk it up to their colleagues. And the one thing you have to be aware of in this industry is it's a, you know, almost the state and local tax world is still a very small industry, and everybody seems to know one another. So if you work in retail, distribution, manufacturing, and you do a great job for somebody, they're going to talk to their colleagues, to their professional colleagues, mm-hmm. and that's going to lead to additional business with us.
Absolutely. So Jim, you mentioned that you joined Altus because of its reputation as well as its, you know, rapid U.S. expansion. You know, Altus in itself has several different business units that have an immense amount of data. Was that important to you? And if so, can you elaborate a little bit more on how that affects you in your everyday business?
Yeah, no, I think it's very important, especially as so far it's been on the real estate side where we've seen just the ability to kind of harness that data, provide more value to our clients, which helps them manage their real estate expense more. We're still early on in that process, you know, with hopefully working towards a national tax software solution that we can use internally, where we'll be able to provide the information to our clients that can sit there and allow them to take a look at their real estate portfolio and look at real estate taxes as kind of a benchmarking area. And that's kind of where our focus has been. When we go to the market, our clients don't have that type of information oftentimes. They may have multiple providers around the country, but no one getting back and saying, here's how your property compares to the market. Where what we're trying to do is provide that one source where we can do the work around the country because we have resources around the country that can provide the consulting expertise, but we can also give them the information they need that will allow them to say, hey, in the property tax area, we are fairly assessed, we're underassessed, we're overassessed. Let's look at that. How do we compare it to our market set? Which they can then hopefully, you know, they use when they go to market to lease up a building. Mm-hmm. You know, how does property taxes for my building compare to the one across the street that you're considering? You know, it'll help them more than just managing the expense, but hopefully manage their business better.
Yeah, what I find interesting on the sales side is that, you know, Altus as a whole, our tax evaluation practice, represent over $435 billion of real estate nationally, and we just have the ability to tap into that data and various components to create those cases for our clients, which is phenomenal. So Jim, you mentioned that you put yourself through college. You know, where did you work, or do you have scholarships, full ride athletics?
Sure,
tell me about that.
I wish I did, but no, I played basketball through high school, but wasn't good enough to play at the level where they were going to, you know, offset my college costs when I went to college. So I put myself through college, went to the University of Baltimore, where I graduated. And so I started working at a restaurant, an ice cream store called Friendly's Restaurants when I was in high school. And so I worked starting in high school because I had to pay for car insurance, how to buy myself a car, you know, how to pay all those expenses. So I started there and became a supervisor while I was there in when I turned, I think, 18. So,
very nice.
So I went from being the person that, you know, cooked food, scooped ice cream, washed dishes, to supervising shifts. And I kept that job through college. And then in my junior year, I also bartended, which was, I will say, much more entertaining than working as a supervisor at a Friendly's restaurant.
It's just like a high-octane scoop of ice cream.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I worked at a private club in downtown Baltimore called the Engineering Society for 2 years, which was about, probably a half mile away from my college. So it was easy to get there, work in the evenings, work weekends. So bartending was fun. You get to meet a lot of interesting people that are having a good time. So those two jobs helped me offset the cost of college. So when I got out of college, You know, I paid as I went, and every semester you worked really hard to make sure your bills were made for the next week and or the next semester. As part of that, I lived at home.
So you've always been selling and always been creating.
Yeah,
which is phenomenal.
Yeah, trying to find ways to kind of set the goals for your career. Getting out of college was the first goal. Mm-hmm. Second goal was, what kind of job am I going to get? And then when I was an accounting major, so got active in addition to going to college. I mentioned earlier, got active in the accounting society mm-hmm. at the University of Baltimore,
and which everyone is raising their hand to sign up for.
Right, right. Well, that's if you're an accounting major, is one of those things you kind of have to go through that thing, but. You know, when you get into that, it's a matter of saying, okay, here's where I am now. I'm a member. I like this, but let's make it fun for everybody that's involved with.
And make it worth something.
Yeah, make it worth something. You want people to get value. If they're going to spend time, you know, it's not just to show up. It's to get in and you give back and you provide value to the organization. So thankfully I was, elected as president. So we started doing some fun things and tried to make sure the activities were good. It wasn't just about going in there and listen about what the industry of accounting was like,
mm-hmm.
but it's about networking and
creating
meeting people, right? Exactly, and inviting those firms, the local firms, in the Big Four firms in, and that I'm glad I got a job, but I think the better part is that many of us that were in that group all used those connections, resources mm-hmm. to get those first jobs out of college. So I actually, the University of Baltimore was great to me, and after I graduated, I continue to be active and involved at the university, initially on a career development committee. I went back and I obtained my MBA there. So,
Self-funded.
So that was one of those things. One of the benefits we had at SCNH was we provided, I didn't have to self-fund it at that point in time.
One of
the benefits we said was, if you go back to college, we'll give you the IRS legal limit to continue your education, because at the end of the day, you're going to be a better professional as you continue to educate. Once you get your bachelor's degree, your education's not over.
Mm-hmm.
You have to continue to go and get that. Whether it be, nowadays there's so many tools that you can get a lot of it online. But going back to college, it was also just a great experience, not just from the, getting the education of the MBA and kind of getting a better, more well-rounded business person and business professional. It was networking. I mean,
mm-hmm.
at the end of the day, we were trying to grow a business. And I was working, and part of my job was to help grow that business. So I obtained contacts through my MBA classes that led to work at my company.
Absolutely.
So and those are relationships that I still maintain with some of my colleagues that I went to graduate school with. So and I'm still active at the University of Baltimore. I've been on the accounting advisory board for many years. So we've done a lot of nice things with the university, with bringing an accounting honors program into place. Again, it's about helping the students that are going through this university, to help them get a leg up and help them kind of think and focus
mm-hmm.
on their career.
So now, question for you. What is your favorite flavor of ice cream?
My favorite
flavor go-to.
Of ice cream. So after my days, there were so many different flavors, but mint chocolate chip was always the one that I liked. So.
Got it.
Interesting question.
Jim, thank you for your time this afternoon. Just one final question. And this is specifically for someone coming out of college. What advice would you give me coming out of college, coming into the workplace?
Yeah, interesting question. There's probably a lot of different pieces of advice you could try to give someone. But the one thing I would say is that, it's important to realize it is your career. And don't rely on others to kind of guide you through that path. You need to have some goals and objectives for yourself. Set them. Find people to help you obtain them. I've always been lucky to have, I'll call, informal mentors in my life. Professionals that I've worked with that respect that have been able to provide some guidance. Find people like that you can rely on, that you can bounce ideas off of, that you trust. Set your goals and go get them. Don't rely, today's generation, it's all about text and email. It's not. It's about developing relationships with people, with mentors, with your clients, with individuals that look out for you, that you care for. We're not numbers, we're people. And you got to look at that as, what kind of difference can you make to be successful? And don't forget to give back to others.
Jim,
so
thank you.